Welcome to the podcast of Sound Medicine, Public Radio's weekly health news magazine. I'm your host, Barbara Lewis. This free podcast is produced by WFYI Indianapolis in association with Indiana University and the IU School of Medicine, and is presented in part by IUPUI, what matters where it matters. I'm Barbara Lewis. Today on Sound Medicine, ever wonder if your child isn't growing tall enough? The problem might be the growth charts themselves.
And even when babies drop or change percentiles, we start to get worried.
We'll speak with a specialist about short stature.
I think it's important to realize that short stature in itself is not a disease, but it can be a sign of a disease.
Plus, waiting for a verdict on e-cigarettes.
I would say to the companies that are making e-cigarettes, show the public that they're in fact a safe and effective treatment.
The new strategies that food activists are deploying.
That's how this system works, and everybody better get used to it because it's not going away.
Taking care of your voice.
So if I'm walking down the street and I hear someone who has a little huskiness, and if they're talking nonstop, I have the idea that they're probably a vocal overuser.
And turning a health problem into a new business.
Let's flip the negative stigma and give it the proper meaning of what it is, which is something that's life-saving.
That and a lot more. Coming up next on Sound Medicine.
Sound Medicine is produced by WFYI in association with Indiana University and the IU School of Medicine, and is presented in part by IUPUI, what matters where it matters.
Welcome to Sound Medicine, Public Radio's weekly news magazine about medicine and health. I'm Barbara Lewis. We begin this week with a question that more than one new parent has lost sleep over. Is my child growing properly? You've probably seen the charts that many pediatricians rely on to measure growth during the first year of a child's life. But Dr. Erin Carroll, a professor of pediatrics, recently completed a study that found that those growth charts might not be the best way to measure a baby's progress.
If you look at the history of how those growth charts were put together, they're what we call cross-sectional. They just take lots of kids at different ages. They see how big they are at those ages, and then they say, okay, well, 95% of kids are this big, and 90% of kids are this big, and 25% are this big, and we set the curves. And when you look at the way the charts are formulated, there are these very nice curves that make it so that people believe that the kids should be growing on this very nice stable curve. If they're at the fifth percentile here, they should be at the fifth percentile up there. And even when kids or babies drop or change percentiles, we start to get worried. In fact, there's a lot of people and a lot of pediatricians that believe if a baby drops two growth percentiles in 6 months, it's what we call failure to thrive. Something is wrong. What we set to do in this study was to actually look at whether babies follow those curves, because the way the charts are put together, it implies that they do, but that's not how they were formulated. And what we found was that tons of children drop at least one or two lines over the course of a year. We found that significant percentages of kids dropped at least one, if not two or more growth percentiles. Only about 35%, I think it was, stayed the same or went up. So the vast majority of children fell. About a third of children dropped two growth percentiles in a six-month period and will be labeled, therefore, failure to thrive. That's a real problem because it implies to parents, it implies to doctors, that we're not giving kids enough to eat. That's not the real problem in America.
Yeah, well, that's it. I mean, how are parents supposed to read that? Because you know that that's new parents especially. I mean, that's a topic of conversation, what percentile
and
your child is in.
I completely agree, and it's been one of my pet peeves for a long time that I think that there's this over-focus on the curves, on the idea that the kids that are plotted this percentile at this age are supposed to be at this percentile at this age, that there is some kind of projection that we can make based upon where they are now as to where they should be later. We're actually conducting a study right now to see if that is exactly true. But what this study did show was that tons and tons of kids will drop their percentiles over the first year of life. The idea that they do so does not necessarily indicate that something is wrong or that we have to start convincing parents that they have to feed their children more.
Well, and can that be connected to the obesity epidemic?
Well, hesitate to think that this is the cause of the obesity epidemic. Certainly, that has a ton of reasons, many of which are far beyond this. But I have seen personally in clinic, I've spoken to residents who, you know, will come to me with the growth curves and talk about how a child has dropped two curves and they want to start supplementing the feeds. And you look at the child and you know, this child's getting plenty to eat. But because there's this fixation on the curve, people do start to get concerned that when they fall off the curve, as we like to say, that there's a real problem. There's very little evidence that that's the case.
That's Dr. Erin Carroll, who directs the Children's Health Services Research Program at the IU School of Medicine. Dr. Carroll is one of the co-authors of the study on growth charts that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association Pediatrics in July. Still, as children grow up, some of them just don't get as tall as their parents expect. It's called idiopathic short stature. Idiopathic is one of those great medical terms. It means we're not sure what caused it. Dr. Lori Cohen recently wrote a paper offering some advice for parents who are wondering why their children are short. Dr. Cohen is the director of the neuroendocrinology program at Boston Children's Hospital, and she spoke with Sound Medicine's Jill Dittmeier.
Short stature refers to anybody who is short, and there is a definition for that. So a definition of somebody being short means they are more than 2 standard deviations below the average for their age and sex. And 2 standard deviations is about 2.3 percentile, so a little bit less than 3% of the population. When somebody is defined as having idiopathic short stature, it just means we don't know what the cause of their short stature is.
So how do you find out what to determine if somebody does have idiopathic structure then?
So when we have a child who is short, we want to determine what the cause of that short stature may be. So we want to look at their growth pattern. Have they always been short? Have they been taller but just haven't grown well, so they are now short at this point in time? And we can divide that into 4 basic categories. So there are going to be kids who are normally short just because their family members are short. There are kids who are going to be short because they may have an underlying condition that limits their growth. This can include problems with bones or other syndromes. They may not have grown well because they have an underlying illness, either an illness where they can't use nutrients, they're either not taking enough in their diet or they're not absorbing them as if they have some sort of gastrointestinal disease, or they may have diseases that really limit how much they can grow because their body is working to take care of itself. So somebody who has a congenital heart disease, or I should say a bad congenital heart disease. And finally, there are kids who do have endocrine conditions, so things like low thyroid hormone or lack of growth hormone.
What age should a parent be concerned about their child's height?
So a parent should be concerned about their child's height if they are not on the growth chart. They should be concerned about their height if they are at a certain percentile and then they are starting to fall off. Now, parents should remember that in the first couple of years of life, kids may change percentiles on their growth chart as they get away from that wonderful environment when they're inside mom's uterus and gaining all that nutrition and going towards their own genetic potential. They also may change percentiles during the teenage years because children who are early developers are going to increase their percentiles and children who are late developers are going to decrease their percentiles until they get back to where they should be. But during the ages of maybe 3 to approximately right before puberty, kids tend to stay on their same percentiles within a little bit of a wiggle room around that.
Do you see now, this more common in boys than girls or girls than boys?
So it is a little bit more common for normal changes in growth pattern in boys. There's just a wider range of variation of normal around the onset of puberty, and so they're going to be more likely to change their percentiles. But in general, in terms of short stature, since it's defined based on sex, you're going to have that same amount whether you're male or female. In general, however, boys come to medical attention about 2 times that of girls, and that may be societal pressures.
So once we've identified that our child might have this idiopathic structure problem, what can we do?
So it depends on what's causing it. So if a child is short and they've been growing poorly because they have an underlying medical condition or they're not eating well, that can easily be corrected. If a child has a known hormonal problem, if they're truly growth hormone deficient, they can receive growth hormone. If they truly lack thyroid hormone or have decreased levels of thyroid hormone, that can be replaced. If they're just going to be short because family is short, that may be who they are. And likewise with syndromes. Now, growth hormone has been approved for some kids who are very, very short, or some kids who have specific syndromes such as Turner syndrome. And in those cases, an endocrinologist may choose to prescribe growth hormone.
And I guess hormone treatment is safe for kids then?
So in the short term, growth hormone has a very good safety profile. We certainly don't know in the very long term, when children are now 70, 80 years old, whether that will have made a difference. If you're talking about somebody who's growth hormone deficient and you're replacing what is missing, that's probably different than if you're giving growth hormone to somebody who already makes some. And safety may depend on exactly how much growth hormone you give.
How often are hormones involved in short stature?
Well, that's a very good question that we really don't have an answer to. If you're talking about the incidence of growth hormone deficiency, people had initially estimated it as more like 1 in 10,000 kids or more common. It's been diagnosed much more in the recent era, partially because we don't have the tools to make a good decision as to somebody who has a partial growth hormone deficiency versus somebody who's a normal variant. So it's very difficult to quantify how many children do have a growth hormone problem and how many children would benefit from growth hormone.
We're speaking to Dr. Lori Cohen. She's the director of the neuroendocrinology program at Boston Children's Hospital. And talking about that treatment with growth hormone, I know you wrote in a paper in JAMA about the cost-benefit ratio for it, calling it controversial. Can you explain that?
So it's an expensive treatment. It can cost more than $20,000 a year. And in a child who's just short without an underlying diagnosis of growth hormone deficiency, the average gain in height might be about 2 inches. It can be much more if it's somebody who does have a growth hormone problem that we've had difficulty diagnosing, or it could be absolutely nothing. And it's unclear what the benefits of, say, 2 inches are in terms of a child's life as an adult.
So what should parents do? What should they look for, and at what point do they need to take a little bit closer look at the fact that their child is short?
So a parent should follow along with the pediatrician. So always very important to have regular well child care checks with the pediatrician. And growth is a wonderful, what we would call, vital sign. So a child who isn't growing well, that can be a mark of an underlying health problem. As they're looking along with the pediatrician on that growth chart, if the height seems short for society, if the height seems very short for family, or if the child is really falling off at the percentiles, then that child probably needs some further evaluation. Often that's started with a pediatrician, but she or he may choose then to refer the child to a pediatric endocrinologist for more testing. I think it's important to realize that short stature in itself is not a disease, but it can be a sign of a disease. And also people should remember that growth hormone really is not the treatment for every child out there who is short. And there's really nothing wrong with being short.
Thank you so much, Dr. Cohen. We appreciate your time today.
You're very welcome.
Dr. Cohen is the director of the neuroendocrinology program at Boston Children's Hospital. We've posted links to her recent article published in JAMA and to the paper Dr. Erin Carroll was discussing from JAMA Pediatrics. It's all on our website. Just go to soundmedicine.org.
I'm Eric Metcalf, and today's Sound Medicine stat is 10,000. When it comes to giving medicine, the spoonful of sugar seems like pretty sketchy advice, and well, so do spoons in general. That's the message of a new study that followed up with parents whose kids received a prescription for liquid medication in the ER. About 41% of the parents wound up giving an incorrect dosage. Parents who used a teaspoon or a tablespoon instead of measuring in milliliters were more likely to mess up the dose. Compared with their efficiency with, say, pudding, kitchen spoons are very shoddy for delivering medicines. They're not uniformly sized, and their abbreviations, which is TSP and which is TBSP, are similar. In 2012, the nation's poison control centers logged more than 10,000 calls about mixed up units of measure related to a medication. To help avoid this outcome, experts say doctors, pharmacists, and parents should make friends with the metric system, discuss medications in terms of milliliters, and leave the spoon in the silverware drawer. That was the number 10,000, and I'm Eric Metcalf.
Coming up, how online activists are affecting the processed food industry.
I'm a blogger, and I have people commenting on my blog all the time in ways that I don't consider particularly collegial.
And later, how you can protect your voice from damage.
So if I'm walking down the street and I hear someone has a little huskiness, and if they're talking nonstop, I have the idea that they're probably a vocal overuser.
You're listening to Sound Medicine. Welcome back to Sound Medicine. I'm Barbara Lewis. Jill Dittmeyer joins me now with this week's health news headlines.
Thank you, Barb. The West African Ebola outbreak continues as the World Health Organization reports nearly 1,000 deaths as of the 4th of August. More are anticipated as new cases of the virus are being reported in Nigeria. Meanwhile, two American healthcare workers infected with Ebola were safely transported to Emory Hospital in Atlanta, where both seem to be improving. Their progress may be due in part to an experimental drug called ZMAP that's derived from tobacco leaves but has not been tested on humans.
The idea is that it could be fairly quickly replicated and grown if it's shown to be effective, but at this point it's in the very early stages of development.
That's Ross Silberman, professor of health policy and public health law at Indiana University.
Let's be clear, this is not an approved treatment, but in past cases, for example, where there were a limited number of flu vaccines, for example, prioritizing first-line providers in those circumstances so that they can treat as many possible people, something that is morally justifiable.
Silberman doubts that there will be further use of the drug anytime soon.
It's inappropriate for us to just start sending this out to anyone who asks for it at this point because we don't have any idea if this would help or possibly harm them. There really should not be absent knowledge of whether this is safe or effective, any kind of large-scale human trials at this time. We need to make sure we have a strong safety process through the FDA that helps us to understand when medications or vaccines are showing effectiveness and how much we should be giving.
The World Health Organization is convening a meeting of medical ethicists to examine what it calls the responsible thing to do about any supplies of ZMAP that eventually could become available. Reporting for Sound Medicine, I'm Jill Dittmeyer.
Health news headlines are presented in part by the Marion University College of Osteopathic Medicine in Indianapolis.
The FDA's extended comment period on how to regulate electronic cigarettes ended this week, but there's still no timetable for issuing the final guidelines. The concern among many physicians is that the battery-powered devices are delivering not just nicotine vapor, but other chemicals as well, including flavorings that might attract younger smokers. The regulations proposed back in April would ban sales of e-cigs to anyone under 18 and would add warning labels and would require new devices to be approved before they could be sold. Dr. Michael Fiore is the founder and director of the University of Wisconsin Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention.
The bottom line is we don't have a lot of science to guide people. They've not been submitted to the FDA for the FDA's consideration of them as a smoking cessation treatment. And the FDA for any drug says you have to prove that it's safe and effective. I would say to the companies that are making e-cigarettes, submit your products to the FDA, get them tested, show the public that they're in fact a safe and effective treatment. And if that were the case, then I'd be all for them. What we know is that it needs to be really a three-legged stool to further reduce tobacco use. And in my view, the possibility of eliminating cigarettes from our society is now within our grasp. I would say there are three things. First, we've got to protect kids from ever starting. And we've made progress with kids' initiation rates falling, but still too many children become addicted to tobacco. And one way to do that is to raise the age at which an individual can buy tobacco from 18 to 21 to further protect kids. Second is making science-based smoking cessation treatments readily available to everyone who wants them. And then the third leg of this three-legged stool is policies. And this is what's going to be particularly effective, I think, with some of the more disadvantaged members of our society. If we make every indoor environment smoke-free, that's going to discourage smoking. People are very sensitive to price. So if we were to, for example, as a federal committee recommended a few years ago, raise the price of cigarettes by $2 per pack, a $2 per tax excise tax increase, and dedicate $1 of every $2 that's raised to help people to quit, would have the resources available to help more people to quit. And finally, we need to spend a lot of time reaching out to these underserved members of our society, individuals who are struggling with so many other challenges like mental illness. We really don't know if they need more intensive treatment, if they need different treatments. We've got plenty of treatments we can try now, but we got to do a much better job reaching out.
That's Dr. Michael Fiore. He is head of the Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention at the University of Wisconsin. I'm Barbara Lewis. Consumer Reports published a national survey this summer, which found that nearly 60% of consumers check labels to see if what they are buying is natural, even though there is no agreed-upon definition for what natural actually means. So now Consumers Union, the magazine advocacy arm, is gathering signatures online to petition the FDA to get rid of the word natural from food labeling. It's just one example of how activists are changing what we eat and what we know about what we eat. Marion Nessel has been following the twists and the turns of the food industry for years from her perch as professor of food studies and public health at New York University, and she joins me now. Marion Nessel, welcome back to Sound Medicine.
Oh, glad to be here.
Well, we want to talk about the growing power that consumers seem to be wielding against food manufacturers. But first, can you give us a sense of how much influence the big players in the food industry hold? I mean, the Coca-Colas, the Pepsis, the Kraft Foods. How much say do they have over what they put in their products?
Well, they have to put in their products what they're allowed to put in their products. Then they must label their products according to FDA rules. They own lots of products in the supermarkets and have enormous distributions and make billions of dollars a year.
Yeah. So how well-positioned is the FDA to yank ingredients from our food and beverages?
Well, the FDA has the authority to remove products from the food supply that are demonstrably unsafe. Proving that something is demonstrably unsafe is not particularly easy, and the FDA doesn't have a huge staff or a huge amount of money to do the work that it does. But by and large, it depends on large companies following the rules, and mostly they do.
Let's turn to the power of the masses. You know, pre-internet, what are some examples of consumers rallying to get an ingredient or a product off the market they perceived as harmful?
Well, I suppose the best example is pink slime, where someone who describes herself as a mommy blogger but is actually a Harvard-trained lawyer discovered that this ingredient, lean, finely textured beef ingredient, was being added to her kids' lunches and didn't like the sound of it, thought it was really not made very well, that it wasn't safe and it wasn't nearly as nutritious as real meat, and started a campaign to get rid of it and got rid of it. Put the company out of business, actually.
So what's your take on activists who turn to Change.org and other social media outlets to put pressure on companies like Kraft and Gatorade and Starbucks?
How else would they do it is my question. I mean, there really is no other consumer voice that can put pressure on companies that are doing things that consumers don't like very much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but on the other hand, you have vocal consumer groups that have shifted the trajectory of products that are good for public health. Let's take vaccinations, for example, and other places where people gather online, like the comments section, aren't always known for well-reasoned discussion. Does the prospect of a social media flash mob, you know, influencing national policy worry you in any way?
Oh, it certainly does. I'm a blogger, and I have people commenting on my blog all the time, often in ways that I don't consider particularly collegial. But that's how this system works, and everybody better get used to it because it's not going away.
Starbucks, for example, didn't even raise an objection, didn't even really say too much of anything before it took its insect-derived dye off. Compare that to some other companies like Kraft, who changed some of the coloring ingredients in some of their products, but left their traditional macaroni and cheese yellow food coloring kind of the same.
It's interesting to me that so many of these campaigns are focused on very tiny ingredients that are consumed in very small amounts, and about which there's very little evidence about efficacy or safety or any of the other kinds of things. Now, many of these substances have not been tested. Some of them have been, but either got by or were assumed to be safe by the FDA. And it seems to me that this is part of a movement to having foods have fewer additives and fewer chemical substances added to them. And it seems to me in the long run, this is a good idea.
Mm-hmm. So the bigger picture here is that big food companies will be a lot more careful of what they put in?
I think they need to be more careful, and they need to be more transparent about what they're doing and be willing to work with the public about some of these things. I think taking some of these chemicals out of the food supply, I don't know whether it'll make a difference to health, but those compounds certainly aren't promoting health for the most part. And if it's possible to remove them, I think it's terrific to have them removed. Now, the dyes and the flavors, that ingredients that are added to foods, are there for cosmetic purposes. They're there to make the food taste palatable, because otherwise it's so highly processed that it wouldn't be. So here again, you want to be eating foods with fewer added chemicals to them.
Do you see a time when people might get tired of signing change.org petitions about food?
I've already reached that point.
Okay.
I mean, I get change.org petitions every day, and mostly I don't read them anymore. Many of them seem frivolous to me and don't seem like the kind of issues that I want to spend a lot of time arguing about.
And any danger of, I mean, because when we're talking about additives that simply change color of a product, and like you said, some chemicals that really just don't even really need to be there. But is there any danger of the food supply getting less safe if, some of the petition drives and some of the public outcry is over things that actually make the food safer?
Yes, I think it certainly does make a difference, but companies are not, really don't want to be poisoning their customers. That's really not what they're trying to do. What they are trying to do is sell their products at the lowest possible price. So if they can put a color in and make it attractive to people and so that people want to buy it, they're going to do that, and they're not going to worry so much about the long-term safety of that color if there's no evidence that the color is harmful at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Maybe
it's harmful in rats. Maybe it's harmful in mice. You have no idea whether that means it has any effect in humans. These studies are extremely difficult and expensive to do. So a precautionary approach is to get rid of them. Mm-hmm. And if there's some evidence that they're harmful, getting rid of them, it seems to me, is a very good idea.
What about Gatorade dropping the BVO? What do we know about BVO? Or should we be very concerned about that? Because it depends on what you read.
Well, it's brominated vegetable oil. And again, there are studies that show that it's harmful to animals. It's very unclear what it does in people. And it's very unclear what it does at the levels that it's found in these foods. On the other hand, Gatorade is a very highly artificially colored product. And there's no reason why it needs to be.
So do you see, we certainly love our local food and sustainable food. I mean, do you see us getting to, even with big food companies, healthier products with less ingredients? Are we headed that way?
Well, certainly there's a niche in the grocery store of products that are advertised as natural and don't have a lot of artificial ingredients added and are promoted as healthy natural, close-to-nature products, and there's an audience for those.
Mm-hmm. But there's people who can't afford the... They tend to be more expensive, and then there are...
Well, yes, they tend to be more expensive because they're designed to appeal to elite shoppers who have money, have education, and know and are trying to do something about their health.
Okay, so we're not kind of making two classes of people, people who can afford to eat healthy.
But we do have two classes of people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we do. We have a small, extremely small segment of the food supply that is purchased by people who have enough money and are educated and care deeply about their health and what food does to their health and are very educated about it. Those are the people who are buying the products that are advertised as healthy and natural. And then you have consumers for whom the main issue is price.
Well, Marion Nestle, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for your opinions and your insight.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Marion Nestle is the Paulette Goddard Professor of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University. She blogs at foodpolitics.com, and her latest book is Eat, Drink, Vote. And it's time now for this week's Sound Medicine Checkup. Want to save your life? For men, the answer is get married. And no, living together doesn't cut it. Jill Dittmeyer explains the research.
Dr. Stephen Blumberg is a researcher at the National Center for Health Statistics. His dad, Joe, is executive director of the Men's Health and Wellness Center in Atlanta. One night over dinner,
we were talking about men's health, as we often do, and he was sharing some anecdotes about how wives and daughters and mothers have an influence on men and their behavior seeking health care.
Stephen knew he had some data on the topic.
In this study, we found that not only did married men go to the doctor more often than cohabiting men, but you know, married men were more likely to have had their blood pressure checked, their blood cholesterol checked, and to have had a fasting test for high blood sugar or diabetes.
Which made them ask,
what is it about being married as opposed to having a girlfriend that influences one's healthcare behaviors to the extent that it does?
Blumberg thinks it has something to do with a man's vulnerability.
Men prefer to think of that they're going to live forever, or that they're invincible. Well, husbands may be more willing to talk about such vulnerabilities with wives, and wives may be more comfortable pushing the issues and talking to men about their vulnerability. Because of that, wives may also be more willing to make the doctor's appointments for their husbands and push them to going to those appointments.
Whereas guys with girlfriends really don't want to blow that image.
And girlfriends may be more reluctant to challenge the guy's self-image as strong and macho and invulnerable.
But that short-term feel-good behavior could lead to long-term bad health.
We know from this that spouses may play an important role in encouraging husbands to seek health care, particularly preventive health care.
And is there any chance that since this report came out that you know of any men who were cohabitating that have now proposed?
No, I don't.
Reporting for Sound Medicine, I'm Jill Dittmeyer.
Do you want to listen to Sound Medicine anytime? Sign up for our free weekly podcast. Click the box at our website, soundmedicine.org. You can also find us at iTunes, at Stitcher Radio, and at Swell AM.
Sound Medicine is produced by WFYI in association with Indiana University and the IU School of Medicine and is presented in part by IUPUI, what matters where it matters. Don't have you now, 114.
Welcome back to Sound Medicine. I'm Barbara Lewis. So whether you're an auctioneer or a singer, I don't know, a radio show host, your voice is more than just a tool for ordering pizza. But a lot of us take our vocal cords for granted, at least until they stop working. And that's when we turn to people like laryngologist Dr. James Thomas. Dr. Thomas specializes in voice issues. Welcome to Sound Medicine.
Hello.
Could you give us a quick explanation of the structures we use to speak and to sing?
I like to think of breaking it down into two parts, and it's all involved in the upper part of our airway. The throat part, or the part near the Adam's apple, is where the vocal cords are, and that's how we make sound. And then above that, the mouth, we modify that and change things into words and sentences and phrases, and that's where we get speech. So voice is the sound, it's the part that's in the neck where the Adam's apple is, and speech is everything above that. And then to make that sound, the vocal cords are two muscles that can be opened for breathing, or they can be closed together, and we blow air from our lungs through them, and they vibrate. And then depending on how tight we make them, that changes the pitch of our voice.
What are the most common and perhaps surprising ways that people injure their voice?
I like to think of three categories. One is overuse, people who talk too much. Underuse, people who don't talk enough. And people who talk incorrectly. So these are three common problems. People who talk too much, the people who don't shut up, who talk all the time. The vocal cords rub together, and just like on your hands, you can get calluses and blisters from digging in the garden. If you talk too much, you can get calluses and blisters of the vocal cords, and we would call them polyps or nodules. So that's overuse injuries. People who don't talk enough, people who are real quiet, don't use their voice a lot. When they do have to use it, those muscles aren't in very good shape, and they sometimes suffer from a soft voice or discomfort or pain because the vocal cords aren't in good, healthy shape. And the third category there is people who don't use it properly. Sometimes we tighten too much or not enough, and we can get some funny sounds out of our throat if we're not using our vocal cords correctly.
So I have heard that clearing your throat can also cause problems. Is that true?
I may be in the minority, but I don't think it actually does. Clearing the throat can be a sign of two things. One, that the secretions are a little bit thick. And the other thing, that if you have any kind of, even a small bump, tiny nodule, or some problem with the vocal cords vibrating, your mucus, which is there to lubricate the vocal cords and help them vibrate, will tend to accumulate on the part that's not vibrating well. So people with problems will tend to clear their throat more. That is, people with really sticky secretions, or people who have some sort of problem in there will tend to clear it more. But I don't think the clearing actually does a lot of damage.
I don't know what category, you know, if we go to a concert and we're talking, trying to talk over the music, or we're at a child sporting game and we're screaming and cheering them on. Is that overuse or incorrect use, for starters?
I would think of that as overuse, and I'll differentiate that a little bit between people who chronically overuse their voice, people who can't shut up, love to talk. They tend to get more calluses, and that is thickenings on the vocal cord that are kind of hard, the skin hypertrophies, and that's what a callus is. And people who acutely overuse their voice, football game on a Friday night yelling, or, as you said, a lot of background noise, so you're actually speaking quite loudly, you can get acute injuries, and those tend to be ruptures of the little blood vessels that are on the vocal cords, and it'll make a little blister with blood in it, and sometimes that'll hang around and become a polyp or a fluid-filled sac. So people who have a sudden change in their voice after sudden overuse, they're most likely to have just plain swelling. So if you overuse your voice one night and it's husky for a day or two, or you lose it for a day and then it gets better and comes back within 2 or 3 days, that's probably just swelling. If you suddenly lose it when you're really overusing it, you're at some risk for having broken a blood vessel and created swelling, and that would tend to last longer.
So what should you do if you cheered on your favorite sport team or your kid's team a little too much?
Well, let's say you lost your voice. I often hear people say on a Friday night they did that, Saturday they lost their voice, and by Monday their voice was getting better. So When you do overuse it and you don't know what's in there, you don't have a camera to look inside, but if you rest it and it gets better in a day or two, it probably was just swelling. And then if it doesn't get better in a week to 2 weeks, then it was probably something more serious, a polyp or a broken blood vessel or something like that.
So what are the most important things people can do to keep their voice healthy? Let's say we're not severe underusers or severe overusers.
Well, I think the voice does pretty good as it is. If you're not in either of those categories, then you're probably not going to suffer from any problems, and just the normal day-to-day drinking of fluids and using your voice a moderate amount is great for it. The three categories I talked to you about of overuse, underuse, and using it inappropriately are what I would call internal or intrinsic ways of damaging your voice. There are also external ways of injuring the voice. People who use inhalers can get, say, fungus infections. People who smoke cigarettes can get growths or cancers on it. So more than overusing or underusing, not exposing your voice to unusual chemicals at work, tobacco smoke, or any unnecessary medications, that can keep the vocal cords healthy.
Yeah. Are you a fan of vocal exercises?
You know, if you're going to be a voice user, it's good to keep the vocal cords in shape for when you need them. So they probably do play a role there.
Mm-hmm. So like teachers and public speakers or singers, auctioneers, do they need to take special steps to protect their voices?
I'll give you an example, and that would be often in September, I will have a teacher come in around the 1st of October and saying, boy, my throat hurts a lot, aches. And what I'll typically find out is they're a person who doesn't talk much. So when summer comes around, they don't use their voice for 3 months, and they get back into school, and the muscles are too weak to do what they need to do, and it takes a month to get going. So they would benefit from vocal exercises. Now, a chatty person who's a teacher has no trouble when the beginning of the school year comes around because they're talking all the time and the voice is in shape. So I think it depends on how much you use your voice intrinsically.
Mm-hmm. So, Dr. Thomas, it sounds like our vocal system, if you will, is a pretty hardy thing. It takes quite a bit to injure that. Is that true?
I think it's pretty hardy. Although when I walk down the street, I can hear somebody who has vocal nodules or vocal calluses.
Whoa! You have to tell me how you can tell that.
Well, when you get a swelling on your vocal cord, it does two things. When you get a swelling, it increases the mass. And like on an instrument, a guitar, the bigger the string, the lower the pitch. So a person who talks too much and has some nodules, they will tend to have a deeper voice than you expect. And the second thing is when you get a swelling, the vocal cords can't close together, and you'll leak air, so you'll have a little huskiness. So if I'm walking down the street, and I hear someone who has a little huskiness, and their voice sounds deeper than it should, that tells me there's some sort of swelling on their cords. And if they're talking nonstop, I have the idea that they're probably a vocal overuser.
So that's one way to diagnose. I mean, you can diagnose just walking down the street, but how do you, in your office, diagnose and treat common vocal problems?
So as a laryngologist, that is an ear, nose, and throat specialist who really focuses on the vocal cords, I do two things. One, I listen to the voice just like that, and I document how high and how low you can go in terms of pitch, and I know what's normal. I listen to how long you can make a sound. So I do some measurements with my ear on the sound you can produce. And then I have two different types of cameras. One goes through the mouth, or one goes through the nose, and your nose passage and mouth passage all connect in the back. And so a camera put in either way through the nose or mouth can then view the vocal cords. And the cameras are quite good. They're now high-definition video cameras that are quite small and can go in either of those passages, and the vocal cords then can be shown on a big high-definition video screen, and you can look at the structure. And then there's another piece of equipment that a typical laryngologist would have, and that's a strobe light. So then when you make a sound, like I'm talking to you here now, my vocal cords are vibrating 100 times a second. But with a strobe light on them, we can slow it down and watch the vibrations in slow motion. So to diagnose it, I would listen, and then I would look both while the person's just breathing and while they're making sound with a strobe light, and that's how I would diagnose the problem.
So it sounds like technology has really been an otolaryngologist's good friend.
Well, it has. There were actually strobe lights invented in the 1890s, but they were pretty cumbersome. So I would say the last 20 years of miniaturizing and creating high-definition cameras that can slip into openings has upgraded that technical ability, even though it's been around a long time.
Okay. Well, Dr. James Thomas, thank you so much for talking with me on Sound Medicine. It's been a pleasure. I'll pay attention to how much I talk.
All right.
Now I do that from now on. Thank you.
Happy to chat with you.
Dr. James Thomas is a throat specialist in Portland, Oregon. He suggested a number of websites that have tips for protecting your voice. They're all at soundmedicine.org.
I love the yodel, hi-yup-li-a-dee-dee.
And finally, here's an example of making the best of a lousy situation. A few years ago, as the result of Crohn's disease, Jason McIntosh had an ostomy, sometimes called a colostomy. That's when surgeons need to create an opening in the body through which waste is discharged into a bag. And as he told us last fall, Jason pretty quickly saw the situation as a business opportunity. He and his fiance, now his wife Jessica, founded a company called Ostomy, spelled A-W-E, to sell clothing to others who've gone through this surgery.
You know, we just want to get it out in public that it's not something that has to be secret. It's something that someone goes through, and it's a life-saving surgery. I think, you know, it could be right up there with something like a mastectomy. But because it deals with bathroom issues, it's easy comic fodder for people. So it was more of a let's flip the negative stigma, let's be positive, let's have a sense of humor, and give it the, you know, proper meaning of what it is, which is something that's life-saving. So Jessica and I don't have any experience in fashion design. So we were looking at similar products, and they were very medical-looking and not very attractive. And I think that it's a common thing for someone to think that people with ostomies are only elderly individuals, which is not true. Anyone at any age could have one.
And how old are you?
I'm 35 years old.
Okay.
So what we wanted to do was to target more of a younger demographic, to give some sort of interesting, pretty patterns, fashionable, with a little bit of attitude, but at the same time provide security and confidence with someone with an ostomy pouch.
So what was the first invention then? What was your first garment?
Well, we initially came out with a line of what we call booty shorts, which is just kind of like an underwear short.
Mm-hmm.
Looks like regular underwear briefs with a higher lace on the waist. They have pockets on the right or left side because we don't know if someone may not always be on the right side or always be on the left side. And we came out with four or five different styles, and they really caught on. So we added a wrap, which is kind of just like a tube top that you wear around your stomach or abdomen that also has pockets. Then we bled into more of a men's line, and we did wraps with men. We're working on boxer briefs with men and some other athletic type wear right now.
Okay. And then you have your t-shirt line.
Yeah.
Right?
Our t-shirt line again.
So who comes up with the puns and the catchphrases?
Usually it's just Jessica and I sitting around having a beer or something and having a creative meeting where we'll think of some of these things. Stuff like brown bagging it. And what that could mean a couple different things, but a lot of ostomy pouches are brown and they're filled with, you know, mm-hmm. waste and that type of stuff. But it's also, you know, that's related to lunch and bringing your lunch. We have, Papa's got a brand new bag, Mama's got a brand new bag. Everybody poops somehow where, you know, just because we have this surgery, you know, we still go to the bathroom. Gosh, what else do we have? Something like cool stoma bro or something like that. Not many individuals are aware that the opening in the body is called a stoma where the waste exits.
Now, it's fellow colostomates. Am I pronouncing it right?
Right.
Okay.
We usually just call the collection of people an ostomate, and
okay.
We don't really want to label anyone. But mm-hmm. there are three different surgeries. There are colostomies, ileostomies, and urostomies.
So they're your ostomates then, and so
this has become, I looked on your Facebook page, and so this has really become more than just a outlet for, as you mentioned, you know, it's not just an outlet to sell merchandise. It seems to be really almost kind of this support group.
Exactly. Our business really is threefold. And initially, our primary goal is to sell product. Secondly, it is a social online support group where people can come, post their issues, and we have other individuals connected to the page that can offer their support, offer things that they've gone through. But we also like to keep the comedy and the positive spirit going there with that. The third part of our business is we really try to help those IBD and ostomy-related nonprofits by partnering with them each month through a nonprofit program that we have where we give a portion of our sales. At the end of the day, yeah, our business is selling garments, but we take more pride in helping people, flipping the ostomy stigma, and helping those that are already doing great work.
So if somebody wants to connect with you, what's the easiest way to do that?
Well, ostomy is a combination of awesome and ostomy. So you can go to ostomy.com, A-W-E-S-T-O-M-Y, or you can check us out on Facebook, facebook.com/ostomy.
All right. Jason, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
Jason McIntosh is co-founder of Ostomy. We'll post a link to his Facebook page on our website, soundmedicine.org.
Hey, if you've got a story of somebody turning an illness into an opportunity, we hope you'll share it with us on our Facebook page. That's it for this edition of Sound Medicine. Our senior producer is Nora Hyatt. Eric Metcalf prepares our interviews. Chris Lieber records and edits the program, and he chooses our music. Jen Burnham manages our website and all things social media. Steve Ali of Jazzville Studios wrote our theme music. And the executive producer is Eric Eggleton. Sound Medicine is a copyrighted 2014 production of the Indiana University Trustees and WFYI, Metropolitan Indianapolis Public Broadcasting Incorporated. All rights reserved. I'm Barbara Lewis, wishing you good health.
Sound Medicine is produced by WFYI in association with Indiana University and the IU School of Medicine and is presented in part by IUPUI, what matters where it matters.
Thanks for listening. For more information about anything you heard on this podcast, please go to our website, soundmedicine.org. I'm Barbara Lewis, wishing you good health.